Joshua 18. The whole assembly of the Israelites gathered at Shiloh and set up the tent of meeting there. The country was brought under their control, but there were still seven Israelite tribes who had not yet received their inheritance. So Joshua said to the Israelites, "How long will you wait before you begin to take possession of the land that the Lord, the God of your fathers, has given you? Appoint three men from each tribe. I will send them out to make a survey of the land and to write a description of it according to the inheritance of each. Then they will return to me. You are to divide the land into seven parts. Judah is to remain in his territory on the south and the house of Joseph in his territory on the north. After you have written descriptions of the seven parts of the land, bring them here to me, and I will cast lots for you in the presence of the Lord your God. The Levites, however, do not get a portion among you, because the priestly service of the Lord is their inheritance. And Gad, Reuben, and the half-tribe of Manasseh have already received their inheritance on the east side of the Jordan. Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave it to them." As the men started on their way to map out the land, Joshua instructed them, "Go and make a survey of the land and write a description of it. Then they return to me, and I will cast lots for you here at Shiloh in the presence of the Lord." So the men left and went through the land. They wrote its description on it, on a scroll, town by town, in seven parts, and returned to Joshua in the camp at Shiloh. Joshua then cast lots for them in Shiloh in the presence of the Lord, and there he distributed the land to the Israelites according to their tribal divisions. The lot came up for the tribe of Benjamin, clan by clan. Their allotted territory lay between the tribes of Judah and Joseph. On the north side, their boundary began at the Jordan, past the northern slope of Jericho, and headed west into the hill country, coming out to the desert of Beit Aven. From there it crossed to the south of the slope of Luz, that is Bethel, and went down to Atarot Adar, and on the hill south of the lower Beit Horon. From the hill facing Beit Horon, on the south of the boundary, turned south along the western side and came out at Kiriat Baal, that is Kiriat Yearim, a town of the people of Judah. This was the western side. Then the southern side began at the outskirts of Kiriat Yearim and went west, and the boundary came out at the spring of the waters of Nephtoah. The boundary went down the foot of the hill facing the valley of Ben Hinnom, north of the valley of Rephaim, and continued down into the Hinnom Valley along the southern slope of the Jebusite city, and so to En Rogel. Then it curved north, went to En Shemesh, continued to Geliot, which faces the pass of Adumim, and ran down the slope to the stone of Bohan, the son of Reuben. It continued to the northern slope of Beit Arabah, and on down to the Arabah. Then on it went to the northern slope of Beit Hogla, and came out to the northern bay of the Salt Sea, at the mouth of the Jordan in the south. This was the southern boundary. Jordan formed the boundary on the eastern side. These are the boundaries that marked out the inheritance of the clans of Benjamin on all sides. The tribe of Benjamin, clan by clan, had the following cities: Jericho, Beit Hogla, Emek Kerizes, Beit Arabah, Zemaraim, Beit El, Avim, Parah, Ophrah, Kfar Amoni, Ophni, and Geba, 12 towns and their villages. Gibeon, Ramah, Be'erot, Mizpah, Kephira, Moza, Rechem, Irpil, Tarala, Zela, Heleph, in the Jebusite city, that is Jerusalem, Gibeah, Kiriath, 14 towns and their villages. This is the inheritance of Benjamin for its clans. Chapter 19. The second lot came out for the tribe of Simeon, clan by clan. Their inheritance lay within the territory of Judah. It included Beersheba, Molada, Hazar Shua, Bala, Ezim, El-Tolad, Betul, Horma, Ziklag, Beit Markobot, Hazar Zuza, Beit Loboah, and Sharuin, 13 towns and their villages. Ain, Rimon, Eter, and Ashan, 4 towns and their villages, and all the villages around these towns as far as the Baalat Be'ir, the Ramon, the Negev. This was the inheritance of the tribe of the Simeonites, clan by clan. The inheritance of the Simeonites was taken from the share of Judah, because Judah's portion was more than they needed, so the Simeonites received their inheritance within the territory of Judah. The third lot came up for Zebulun, clan by clan. The boundary of their inheritance went as far as Zarid. Going west, it ran to Maralah, touched Dabasheth, and extended into the ravine near Yokanim. It turns east from Sarid toward the sunrise in the territory of Kislot Tabor and went to Dabarat and up to Yafia. Then it continued eastward to Gat Hefer and to Eitz Kazin. It came out at Rimon and turned toward Neah. There the boundary went around on the north to Hafanon and ended in the valley of Iftah-El. Included were Karat, Na'alal, Shimron, Idalah, and Bethlehem. There were 12 towns and their villages. These towns and their villages were the inheritance of Zebulun clan by clan. The fourth lot came out for Issachar, clan by clan. Their territory included Jezreel, Kesalot, Shenuim, Hapharaim, Shion, Anahatarat, Rabit, Kishion, Ebez, Remet, and Ganim, and Hadah, and Beit Pazaz. And the territory touched Tabor, Shahazuma, and Beit Shemesh, and ended at the Jordan. There were 16 towns in their villages. These towns and their villages were the inheritance of the tribe of Issachar, clan by clan. The fifth lot came out for the tribe of Asher, clan by clan. Their territory included Helkot, Hali, Beiten, Ashaf, Alamech, Ahmad, and Mishal. On the western boundary, touch Carmel and Sihor, Libnat, and then turned east toward the Beit Dagon, touched Zebulun, and went to the valley of Iftah-El, then north to Beit Emek and to Na'il. It turned, passing Kabul on the left, it went to Abdon, Rehob, Hamon, and Cana, and as far as the Great Sidon. The boundary then turned back toward Ramah and went to the fortified city of Tyre, turned toward Hosa and came out at the sea in the region of Achzib, Umah, Aphek, and Rehob. There were 22 towns and their villages. These towns and their villages were the inheritance of the tribe of Asher, clan by clan. The sixth lot came out for Naphtali, clan by clan. Their boundary went from Halef and the large tree at Za'ananim, passing the Adami Nekeb and the Yabneel and to Lakum and ending at the Jordan. The boundary ran west through Azanot Tabor and came out at Hakok. Then it touched Zebulun on the south, Asher on the west, and the Jordan on the east. The fortified cities were Zadim, Zer, Hamat, Rakat, Kinneret, Adamah, Ramah, Hazor, Kadesh, Edrei, Enhazor, Iron, Migdal El, Horem, Beit Anat, and Beit Shemesh. These were the 19 towns and their villages. These towns and their villages were the inheritance of the tribe of Naphtali, clan by clan. The seventh lot came out for the tribe of Dan, clan by clan. The territory of their inheritance included Zorah, Eshtaol, Ir Shamesh, Za'alabim, Ejalon, Ithla, Elon, Timna, Ekron, El Tuket, Gibbeton, Ba'alat, Jehud, Bene Barak, Gat Rimon, Me Yarkon, Rakon, and the area facing Yopa. But the Danites had difficulty taking the possession of their territory, so they went up and attacked Leshem. They took it, put it to the sword, and occupied it. They settled there in Leshem and named it Dan after their forefather. These towns and their villages were the inheritance of the tribe of Dan, clan by clan. When they had finished dividing the land into its allotted portions, the Israelites gave Joshua, son of Nun, an inheritance among them, as the Lord had commanded. They gave him the town he'd asked for, Timnath Serah, and on the country, in the hill country of Ephraim. He built up the town and settled there. These are the territories that Eleazar the priest, Joshua son of Nun, and the heads of the tribal clans of Israel assigned by lot at Shiloh in the presence of the Lord at the entrance of the tent of meeting. And so they finished dividing the land.
Thank you, Jeff, for reading that for us. All right, regarding Joshua 18 and 19. Before I begin, I realize that this is actually, the listing of towns and cities is one of the most boring sections of any book because they're very tedious. So any questions regarding chapter 18 or 19 before I begin my little 10-minute spiel? Yes?
Do you have any idea what time of year the casting of the lots was done at Shiloh?
Fortunately, no. Okay. No time of year is published by anybody.
Okay.
They're strictly curious. Theories.
Well, near a holiday or a high day.
I wouldn't be surprised if it was.
Yeah.
Because we're looking at Shiloh, which is the temple being established there, and everybody being grouped. That would also include people from Reuben and Gad coming over to listen.
Yeah.
So there's a pretty good chance, since that only happens on high days and holy days, there's a pretty good chance it probably was around one of the high days, but no knowledge or proof of anything. Yes.
As well as dividing the land up by lots, I always thought that population of the tribes played a part in it also.
Yes, it does.
I didn't know how that squared all up.
I can explain. I'll explain both briefly right now, actually. It doesn't take that much effort. Many of the tribes were approximately the same size.
Oh, okay.
You have, for example, Benjamin and Zebulun and Issachar were all almost identical populations, as well as the tribe of Dan. There were variations, a few thousand people here or there, but they're pretty close. So any of those lots could have been equally distributed in any one of them. And so you cast lots according to the tribe's size, dictated by lot size. If it happens to be a larger lot, well then, the teeny tribes don't get, their lots are not thrown in with this, with the medium size or larger ones. Judah happened to be a larger one, so was Manasseh at the time, and Ephraim, of course, increases in time as well. So size as well as lots were grouped together. Any other questions or comments regarding that? Yes.
Okay, and I also thought that certain tribes had certain attributes, such as I think Zebulun needed to be near the coast because they were seafaring people, or they were located there and then they became seafaring people.
We're dealing with a prophecy that you're referring to. It's a prophecy listed in the book of Genesis, chapter 49, for those of you who are interested in it. It is a dictation given by Jacob on his deathbed to each of his sons, telling them what their future is going to be like. And in Zebulun's case, which is what we were just referring to, regarding they shall dwell by the sea. Well, the lot that was an inheritance has no water anywhere near or around it. They're landlocked. The prophecies that Jacob was referring to go well beyond what territory was inheritance. We will actually cover a little bit of that today, hopefully, but I know that the theory or the issues regarding these various prophecies in Jacob have been a major base and a huge issue that many people who deciding or dictating who the descendants were, like say, for example, people say, oh, well, France must be descendants of this tribe and this country is descendant of that tribe based on this prophecies of Jacob. And they may or may not be right, but that is independent of the inheritance land that they're inheriting here. That is only, actually, yeah, it's completely independent. Honestly, there's no connection. The prophecy that Jacob gives is independent of inheritance of land.
Okay.
Just bottom line. Don't try to associate the two of them. Any other questions or comments? Okay. Well, I'm going to begin. I originally was going to go through both chapters and was told Jeff briefly, oh, well, we'll just go through the first chapter, but most of my notes have to be in chapter 19 and Genesis 49 rather than chapter 18, but we would discuss 18 because there's one thing, it's a couple of things are rather important to discuss. Of course, verse 1 points out that the tabernacle goes to Shiloh. Now, where is Shiloh? Ephraim. Where in particular in Ephraim is Shiloh located? It's actually on a mountain. Not really a big mountain. It's a kind of small mountain. It's close to the middle section of Ephraim, but more toward their eastern side of their border, as far as the actual location. They have pictures of where Shiloh is. They have what is called Tel Shiloh, or the mountain of Shiloh. Tel is like a hilltop or a mound of dirt. They have photos of what it looks like today and some various archaeology things going on there, which are quite interesting. Some of them are very fascinating archaeological stuff. Shiloh's area is considered a rocky wasteland in Arabic. That's its name. The area where Shiloh is, it's a rocky wasteland. There's nothing there. Where have we heard that before?
The Mount Ebal.
A rocky wasteland. Nobody wants it. What about the whole country of Israel for all practical purposes? What is it? It's a rocky wasteland. Nobody wants it.
It wasn't then,
but it is now, at least large percentages of it. Not to say the whole thing, obviously the whole thing is, but a large percentage of it. And to me, that just notes there seems some kind of a theme that God happens to be playing along here, but that's just a side note. I find it funny. So Shiloh was moved from Gilgal, which is where it was the first either 7 to 14 years. I think it was 7. People who are smarter than me say it was 14. I don't know which one's right. I'm not that educated into dictating exact times. But it was at Gilgal. They were temporarily at Mount Ebal for about a year, which we discussed in previous commentaries. They moved it to Shiloh right after this. Stays in Shiloh for 370 years. It's a long time. That's a really long time. Next 369, close enough to 70. Stays there. The verse 1, I believe, it actually specifies the land was conquered before them. Yeah, land was, the end of verse 1, land was subdued before them. That's actually not true. Land was not subdued before them. Only a small section of the land that was subdued before them, which happened to be in Ephraim's location, where Shiloh was at, and also most of Judah, where Judah was located at, and a good portion where Benjamin gets their territory from. That's the only part that's actually subdued. The rest of it isn't subdued. Well, not yet. It's not supposed to be subdued yet. We just discussed this in previous weeks. What is the requirement for them to be subdued? Well, God gave the Torah. The rule is, if you are inheriting a land, your tribe has to go subdue it and take it. Initially, the whole congregation took the land. They took the eastern side of the Jordan already. They took Judah. They took Ephraim and most of Benjamin, as well as some bits and parts of Dan's territory as well. They stopped. Yes, they conquered the kings and whatever, but they didn't subdue land. They didn't go over and inherit it. Not until it was divvied up amongst the tribes. Now, we also mentioned before, we already know certain tribes got their territory ahead of time. Gad, Reuben, half Manasseh, actually all Manasseh at this point, Ephraim and Judah already had their territory. Why? Well, because, Gad and Reuben, half Manasseh on the east side, the whole congregation was there conquering. on the west side, the two most influential people, Joshua and Caleb, were the only two spies that knew everything of the territories. Those are the areas they inspected, they spied out, they came back with a report about them, so they conquered them first. They're easier. They already knew them. The rest of the spies who observed the rest of the territory were all dead. So there was no one around to say, oh, well, yes, this town has this type of mentality. These types of people are living in it. They don't know that. They have to be sent out to spy it out again, which Joshua tells them to go do. The rest of you, the reigning seven tribes, haven't inherited their land. Go out, spy it out. Now Joshua gives them a rules regarding that. They have to record all this stuff down as far as bring it back. Joshua, he's an old man at this time. He's not going to sit there and go look it out for himself. He's getting approached to his death here. They chose three people from each tribe. What's a rule of law? Three people make a decision. It helps prevent, I guess, the unfair divvying up of land and territory. It's a court of law. There's no difference. Because why is this? Why would Joshua give them an idea or a concept of what's life's going to be like in the land? Well, the same philosophy that Moses had, which is, you're going to be inheriting a territory that I'm not there to tell you what to do anymore. Joshua knows the same scenario. All of you are going to inherit this territory that I'm not going to be there to tell you what to do. You need to learn how to establish your own laws, establish your own rules that govern your people. They've been doing this for 40 years off and on, but at this point they actually have more explicit and physical example of how to make this run. Get a court of law, essentially, that rules your tribe and goes to those various territories and learns them and masters them. Okay. I'm going to skim through some of these comments in order to get back to an old prophecy, so bear with me for a moment. Chapter 19. I want to point out in verse 1, Simeon's heritage. This is due to the prophecy in the book of Genesis. Simeon's heritage was right in the dead center of Judah. Actually, bottom half, more accurately, the dead center. Bottom half of Judah. What did they inherit? Was it large quantities of land? No. Most of Simeon's heritage were cities or towns only, not the surrounding territory. The surrounding territory was already given to the tribe of Judah. It's theirs. They're not going to carving up another tribe again. But they carved it up in the form of cities. This established a prophecy of Simeon that was from Jacob to Simeon. These are the few prophecies that actually showed up. As I mentioned to Louise earlier, don't associate all the prophecies from Jacob to these land of inheritance. Levi and Simeon are the only two that you can really associate, because they actually fulfilled their prophecy early on and stuck with it the rest of their lives. The rest of them haven't received all their inheritance yet or all their prophecy. Judah has, as of today, received theirs from that Jacob gave. And I'll show that to you later, shortly, actually. Simeon's borders were scattered amongst Judah. What does that do? If I have a group of people, and I am scattered amongst a larger group of people, not unified in a single body like all the other tribes are. If I'm scattered, what does that do to my people?
Disappear.
Mm-hmm. Say it again, Joe.
Assimilation.
Well, they pointed out you disappear.
You're absorbed.
Exactly. When Simeon is divided up and scattered amongst the tribe of Judah, what does that do to Judah? In Judah's perspective, what does that do?
Dilutes them.
It gives influence. That's what Levi does, their entire existence. They influence the whole tribe of, all the tribes of Israel. Simeon's scenario divided him up and it fulfilled the prophecy that Jacob gives, which we'll read the prophecy shortly. Just so you familiarize with it, I'm talking you through it right now. As a result in Judah, Simeon then influences Judah. What was Simeon known for?
Violence.
What was Levi known for? violence. Both of those two, Jacob said, you are too violent. You will be divided up amongst Israel, or scattered amongst Israel. And guess what? Both of them get divided up and scattered amongst Israel.
Among Judah, though.
Among Judah, Simeon is scattered amongst. They are not divided amongst the northern tribes. So in Judah, you have an influence, not a controlling, but an influence, of a very violent tribe. Not negatively. I'm not saying that violence is bad. That's not the point. The point is that we're talking about Simeon and the character and how it influences the rest of the tribe of Judah. We already discussed how it influences Simeon and that they get separated. They get scattered amongst it. You get assimilated into the culture. But in Judah's side, it's not so much of an assimilation as it is to an influence. They get influenced. They get changed subtly, slowly over time. That's what happens with those two particular tribes. Levi is the same way. Levi, however, has a divine requirement to also teach regarding prophecy and priesthood. Well, prophecy, more priesthood rather than prophecy. They get influenced the same way. As far as they influence the rest of the tribes the same way. The rest of the tribes receive education, receive knowledge, receive understanding, and Levi is scattered amongst them. So Levi, it dilutes, as you may use the word, or they assimilate over time, but the rest of the tribes always have a permanent connection to God and to who he was and what their requirements are. By the way, that my explanation was given by Rashi years ago, but I'm not going to discuss that too much further. Short distance from now, Judah, actually in the book of Judges, shortly after Joshua dies, Judah and Simeon say, all right, since we're stuck together, we're going to go conquer our territories together. Now, most of Judah's territory is already taken care of. Simeon's, however, a few of his towns have not been taken care of, and a few of Judah's towns haven't been taken care of, so they're going to go join together and wipe out the bad guys, as you can use the term. However, like I said, I'm skimming through this, so bear with me. In Dan, as it points out the tail end of the chapter, it says, all right, Dan inherited this area toward the water, toward the Mediterranean Sea, but it says they were not able to conquer it all, and so they went out to Laish, however you pronounce the word, and renamed it Dan. They took over the little town. We'll actually read that. I believe that the whole scenario is recorded in the book of Judges, I think it's like 17, 18, and 19, the whole process of which Dan takes his territory. Note, it's in Judges that they actually do it. 17, 18, and 19th chapter. Not back here in Joshua's time. So the point is that verse describing that this area was not big enough or was not, they were insufficient to take it, it was written in here in Joshua's book, but it didn't actually happen during Joshua's time. He was long since dead. Matter of fact, a couple of judges come and go before this event takes place. But Dan is unable to take over all of his territory. Why is that? And we recall David and who he fought all the time?
Philistines.
But
they didn't take along the coast.
Exactly. They had a hard time. Now, at this point in time, the Philistines aren't even around. Right? They are slowly showing up over the next couple hundred years. Philistines show up almost, not quite, 200 years later. While they're still in the process of conquering, and they didn't fulfill they didn't complete it all, the Philistines finally show up on the scene. Now they got issues. Why? Philistines are seafaring people. They were at the time. And the Egyptian Ramses, I think the third, recorded that these seafaring people are horrible warriors. They're ruthless. They're disgusting, but they're ruthless. And he records he was finally able to conquer them after many, many years conquered. Not Philistines, not the territory we call the Gaza Strip today, but the invaders from the sea that were also invading Egypt at the same time. The Philistines did a massive onslaught of this territory. Hence we have also Phoenicians that show up with the same scenario. They're not Philistines, but they're associated. Philistines. Word comes from Pelista. Pelisti? Pelisti. Hebrew word. What does it mean? Invader.
I know, but Psalm 108 says that he will triumph over Philistia.
These Philistines are from the Hebrew word of invader. They're invaders. That's the name. Hence, they were not there originally, But they are invaders, so they call them Philistines. They're invaders. Stranger people that showed up. Okay, I'm gonna stop my comments for Joshua 18 and 19. I'm gonna go to Genesis. I wanted to complete all the various tribe allocations of territory. Genesis 49. Bear with me. This is a difficult thing to do, and I hope I will do it with some just, do it well, but if I don't, please forgive me and you can scold me later. I don't know. Chapter 49. I already mentioned earlier, this is the time when Jacob calls all of his sons. This is, they're in Egypt at this time. That he may tell them what happens to them in their future days, or their last days, is actually what it's recorded at. He starts out with the oldest son, Reuben, Levi, and Simeon, and Judah works his way all the way down to Benjamin. What their future is. They don't know what it's going to be, but they're all interested. Reuben discusses as far as you being my firstborn, my might, beginning my strength, verse 3. The excellency of dignity, the excellency of power. You are unstable as water. You shall not excel. Because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. He went up to my couch. Let's stop for a second here. That's the point when Reuben sleeps with his father's wife. Not Reuben's mother, but a concubine of the other lady.
Bilhah.
Bilhah, thank you. Couldn't think of her name. Verse 5. And this verse 5 is actually fulfilled in Simeon and Levi's life. Up all the way in Joshua. They start fulfilling this when the land is divvied up. Simeon and Levi are brothers, instrument of cruelty are in their habitation. Let not my soul enter the council, let not my honor be united to their assembly. For in their anger they slew a man, and their self-will they hamstrung an ox. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. That was a prophecy. I will divide them amongst Jacob, and I will scatter them in Israel, which is exactly what happened. They were two tribes were separated, they were divided. A few Levites scattered here and there, a few Simeons scattered here and there, but they were scattered amongst Israel. Never to be united. Yes, Louise.
Levi gained honor and prestige. How did Simeon feel? She was just sort of brushed aside.
The methodology that God uses to fulfill a prophecy, mind you, these prophecies that Jacob's rattling off, it is commonly believed, and I have no reason to think otherwise, that God revealed these things to him ahead of time. So how God, or the method that God chose for Levi to be divvied up and separated out, that was God's choice. In his scenario, he chose Levi to be... Oh, I'm sorry, there's somebody up there. Ellie? The door? Oh, no, he just dropped it off. That's okay. In Simeon and Levi's case, Levi, they were divvied up and separated out because God wanted them to be tools. He would use them. Simeon's case, it was not the same way. Yeah, they did have different perspectives. Levi didn't receive inheritance. Simeon did. Simeon's inheritance was scattered amongst Judah. No unifying location. Levi's inheritance was scattered amongst Israel. No unifying location. They both have very similar scenarios. But Simeon still received an inheritance that is inheritable, transferred down from generation to generation.
Okay.
Levi, all they got were a couple of towns. Well, a couple, 48 is pretty good. But they got a few cities that they were inherited, but no land. Simeon still got land, even though it was scattered amongst Judah. So there was a give and take.
Okay.
Levi got a few benefits, Simeon got a few benefits, but neither one of them got the full benefits that a formal tribe would get. Yes, come out.
Is it possible that they didn't get, that the Simeon didn't get that full benefit yet? Because there will come a time when the warrior will be needed. And that is when the true tribe of Simeon will shine.
Very possibly. I can't swear to it, but you may have a very good point you're putting on. Yes, Ellie.
Better
hurt. Yeah, with the current issues with Israel, it's kind of questionable. Verse 8. This one I'm focus on a little bit, because this will start showing up with Shiloh, which we just talked about. Now, Shiloh is also a town. It's also a prophecy of a person. Verse 8 says, Judah, you are he whom your brothers shall praise. Your name shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's children shall bow down before you. Judah's a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He bows down, and he lies down as a lion, and as a lion he shall rouse him. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh comes. And to him shall be the obedience of the people, binding his donkey to the vine, and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He washed his garments in wine, and his clothes in the blood of grapes. His eyes are darker than wine, and his teeth whiter than milk. I want to stop here for a minute. Judah's prophecy is actually starting in the book of Joshua with Shiloh. I know it sounds odd. Why is this? Just because of Shiloh's same word both places? Not quite. Shiloh's, the city, has a history behind it. Today, Shiloh's been destroyed. It was destroyed a long time ago. Something happened to Shiloh. It was the location where the tabernacle was established for 370 years. At the end of that 370 years, what happened? Got captured by the Philistines, actually. They destroyed it. They destroyed the city. What was going on in Israel's history at that time? You have Samuel, who's rising up slowly as a young lad. He's still growing up. Eli, the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, his sons, they all took the ark out of Shiloh the year Shiloh gets wiped out. They take it out of Shiloh, and what do? They all go to battle against Philistines. And what happens?
They lost.
The ark is taken to Philistine territory. Now, it goes from a couple of cities in Philistine, they finally send it back. We won't go into that story yet. We'll discuss. But the scenario of taking the ark, the protection of the temple, tabernacle's point, out of Shiloh, what does that do to Shiloh? It's not protected anymore. Easily destroyed. In fact, it was in 1104, burned to the ground, destroyed. The same 1104 BC, the same year or the following year, it's debatable, that the ark was taken. The Philistines took it, just destroyed Shiloh and walked away. It was a deep incursion into Israel to do it, but what did they have on their side? Well, at this point in time,
they stole the ark.
They had the ark, and the protection of Israel's gone. Nothing's stopping them. So that's what they did. They came over, they took the city. This is the part that's interesting with archaeology, which I find fascinating. Bear with me for a moment here. The city of Shiloh, before the Israelites came, was a huge fortified city on top of this little hill covered with nothing but rock all around it. Easily defendable. I mean, any enemy you can see from a long, it's in the top, it's in the middle of this valley. You got miles all around you. You can see enemies coming from large distances. Best place to place an ark. Best place to put the center of your entire religious life at. It's the center of all the tribes. They can all travel there. Easily defendable. Not a problem. Well, as a result, for 370 years, if you happen to have an ark located in this town that is, quote, indestructible, end of quote, what do you do as a people? Well, you don't bother making defenses, do you? You don't bother building walls. And guess what the Israelites did for 370 years? They dismantled their walls and built on top of them houses. There was no longer any protection in Shiloh because they didn't need it. If you have protection, God's protection for 370 years, do you think you need your own mankind's protection in the form of rocks and walls? Of course not. You don't bother thinking about it. Once the ark's gone, there's nothing stopping anybody from taking over your town, which is exactly what happened. Shiloh gets wiped out. And God, of course, uses this as a prophecy and a lesson in future generations, because Jeremiah refers to it, so does... I can't think of the guy's name. He's one of the ones who wrote the Psalms. It wasn't David. It was another guy. He wrote like a brief history of Israel. We've heard the fact that God destroyed Shiloh. The Psalms actually explicitly points out. He destroyed it because they disobeyed his rules. They disobeyed his commandments. Disobeyed his testimonies. So he wiped it out. Shiloh, the word Shiloh means to you whom it belongs. That's kind of funny, huh? I'm going to town, and it's to he who it belongs, is the name of the town. Every Jewish scholar, every Christian scholar, will tell you the same thing about the word Shiloh and the prophecy in the book of Genesis, which we just read. It is referring to the Messiah, hands down. No one argues otherwise, because they know it's not true. If we look at that verse again, those couple of verses actually, it says, a scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until he to whom it belongs comes. And to him, referring to he whom it belongs, shall be, to him shall be the obedience of all the people. This is, I'm sorry, verse 10 and 11 in 49. Binding his donkey, referring to Shiloh, to the donkey to the vine, and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. This is referring to Shiloh, the word Shiloh, meaning the Messiah. Messiah will bind his donkey to the vine, and the Messiah's donkey, and the Messiah's donkey's colt to the choice vine. Messiah washes hands, his garments in wine, and his clothes in the blood of grapes. And the Messiah's eyes are darker than wine, and his teeth are whiter than milk. From the point on, once that scepter changes hands, it is no longer Judah's, it is now the Messiah's. We have an active phone today. I'm going to call it quits here in a minute here. I'm not going to finish the rest of prophecy. It refers to some of the other tribes that I won't get into, because I'm consuming more time than I wanted to. What happens to Judah's history, Israel's history? We know that all of Judah gets captured and all of Israel gets captured, right? And we know that the king of Judah gets, all of his children at least, die. They're all killed. The king, all the king's children are killed during the captivity of the Judah. The king himself is rather grotesque things happen to him before he dies. That's,
what king is it?
I don't recall his name off the top of my head. He's the last king of Judah, though, before the captivity. There's no longer an heir, right?
That's in debate.
No, I'm sorry. I know, yes, there is an heir. I'm telling you right now, it appears he's no longer an heir. So the scepter was lost 600 years before the Messiah shows up.
To the house of Judah.
Well, yeah, to the house of Judah. What happened? What's going on? This is a prophecy. It's the house of Judah, not the house of any other country on planet Earth, any other tribe. It's Judah. It's only Judah. So what happens?
Yeah.
Well, actually, the king had siblings. Where were the siblings? They were in prison, located where these captivity people took them to, Babylon, because they were captured too. So the king, though he himself died and his children died, his brother didn't. His brother was still in Babylon in prison. His brother had children. One of his descendants happens to be Zerubbabel. His brother's descendants passed on and passed through. The scepter never left, meaning the rulership or the ruler or kingship never left. It just changed from one brother to the other brother. And still continued to pass on. Now we'll do a little bit of history before I call it quits. I'm almost done here. So, we have two debates that just showed up. One, the Christian side that says, see, the scepter and rule of Judah happened until the Messiah showed up, now it's gone. One, the Jewish side says, no, it happened 600 years earlier. There was no Messiah. A third one that says, well, actually, history points out there is a relative that did pass through, and actually his line still existed and still grew. Jewish philosophy at the time said, well, they weren't kings, though, right? You could argue they weren't kings because they didn't have the rule of life or death. But most of his children were still very influential in what we call the Sanhedrin, because most of them were still members of the Sanhedrin. Most of that king's children still had the rule of life or death over Judah and over all of Israel all the way until the Messiah died, which I'll record that. I'll write the quote down to you, or I'll read the quote to you in a minute. So the king was brought away, the original one was killed, his brother was not killed. His descendants still come back along with all the rest of the captive when they return. They are one of the main people who rule. But at the point which they return, there's another people in charge. The Hasmoneans is what they're actually referred to. They were the people that actually ruled the physical territory that the king of Babylon, I can't think of his name off the top of my head, that said, all right, you're going to dictate this area. You do the basic law, rules, blah, blah, blah. Well, they conflicted with these groups that came back to captivity that established what is called the Sanhedrin and said, hey, we disagree with you. They fought back and forth bitterly, meaning verbally as well as physically. Matter of fact, the Hasmoneans wind up killing a large percentage of what we call the Pharisees. This battle goes back and forth. But either way, the rule of law regarding who is penalized, what laws are passed, still go through the line of Judah the whole time. They never left. Because while he's still in prison, the king's still in prison, his children are not. They're still very influential amongst the people of Israel, still telling them what God did or didn't do, along with all the Levites, various prophets, including Ezekiel. And Ezekiel, of course, refers to Shiloh as well, saying, hey, guys, pay attention. So they return about 167 or so, I think it was something like that, B.C. They sent Hegem fine and said, okay, now we have complete control. They quelched the Hasmonean heathen people they don't really like. The rule never left. The scepter never left. It just got temporarily moved until one event occurred, which we know as the Messiah's death. There was a quote by a rabbi at the time of the Messiah's, I guess, actually, he's about the Messiah's, but about the time he was bar mitzvah, roughly about 13-ish years old. If I get my piece of paper here, I'll read the quote to you. Ah, yes. Interesting quote. This is prior to the Messiah's death, but at this point in time, who rules Israel? Romans. Romans rule Israel this time. So who dictates life or death? Is it the Sanhedrin?
Romans.
No, Romans do. When the Messiah is 12 years old, guess what law Rome passes? No one else is allowed to dictate life or death, only Rome. They just pulled, quote, the scepter, in a quote, or the power, out of the Sanhedrin when he was 12. The rabbi at the time, which I get my... Rabbi Rachmon... let's see, this is happening, this law was passed by the time Jesus came to the temple, first bar mitzvah, roughly the age 12, 13, so in that range. This is recorded, of course, in Luke. Rabbi Rachmon at the time says, when the members of the Sanhedrin found themselves deprived of their right over life and death, a general consternation took place. It took possession of them because they covered their heads with ashes and we covered our bodies with sackcloth, exclaiming, woe to us, for the scepter has departed from Judah and the Messiah has not come.
Interesting quote.
Fascinating quote, isn't it?
Fascinating quote.
Of course, he's a standard Jewish person, but right. He's not a Messianic believer, but he acknowledged this is terrible. Something is because they lost
they
the power to dictate law in the form of death, life, what is as a king or a scepter would rule. And they were upset. They've lost it.
And then he comes along and he says, I have power to give life or take life.
Exactly.
Exactly.
It's because it stayed in Judah's hands the whole time.
So
up until Rome took it away.
Until he comes.
Which Messiah came in the same... It's believed it was the same year. It's kind of hard to tell. Don't know if Messiah was 12, maybe he was 13. Not completely positive it's the exact year, but it's about the same time slot, so it's a good chance it was the exact same year. But then, of course, they point out that other rabbis point out 30 years prior to, or 40 years prior to the destruction of the temple, various things started to change regarding the doors not being open and the cord not changing colors and various other things for various holidays and holy days, but we're not going to discuss those anymore because I'm going to call it quits because I'm well over time. I hope you appreciated this a little bit.
That was
yeah. I'm to make sure I didn't miss
both
anything.
Both the name Shiloh.
Yeah, both the name Shiloh.
That is fascinating.
Both the name Shiloh. Both
and
of them are associated.
And the fact that should happen at Yeshua's bar mitzvah.
Right.
Which leaving childhood to manhood.
Exactly.
Who then is, he is
the
one
scepter.
Who is to come.
So
the one who is...
Jacob's prophecy that he gave to Judah starts right now in Joshua when Shiloh is established. It's the beginning.
Oh. It's interesting because that quote, Bar Mitzvah, in a quote, what happened during Passover, which would be out of sequence.
Yes.
So it has to be within that year period.
Within that year time.
Not at a specific time of his age, but then it would be logical, would have to at the Passover time.
Okay. Of his Bar Mitzvah, yes. Yes, okay. Ellie? Arachmon. R-A-C-H-M-O-M-O-N? M-A-N. M-O-N. Now, the one thing I don't know for sure is they don't give the actual years it was around. So it is possible that Rabbi Rachmon was not a contemporary, but rather recording what he knew or what had happened.
Right, yeah.
So there's no guarantee. He may not have been actually there at the temple at the moment. It may have been a short time after that he was alive. But it does point out he was alive very early on in Messiah's life, either shortly after. I'm sure there's a lot more than one Rachmon. So I don't know how old he was. I mean, unlike Hillel, they say, oh, well, yeah, he rules from this point to this point. While Rachmon was not a ruler, he was just a normal teacher, no better than anybody else. But he does record that information.
It's interesting because in Jeremiah, people consider that Jeremiah and his assistant took the king's daughters and took them.
That is another theory that they moved to, one of the nations, England or Britain, yeah, something like that. Which may or may not be true, I don't know. All I do know is that he did have a brother who was in prison in Babylon and did have children, and Zerubbabel is one of his descendants. That I do know. They acknowledged that the scepter, yeah, at that point that it passed, right? Not 600 years earlier, as modern day commentators argued in order to extinguish the Christian belief.
Some of the modern day commentaries want to kind of make it more foo-foos, and it really didn't happen that way.
Well, of course.
The old one, figure out what they were thinking when they said it.
They, exactly. It's not easy to do, but
it's hard to search for those things.
Well, yeah, it is.
Too, is the Rachmon does not consider Yeshua as Messiah.
Of course not.
So it's interesting that even from his non-consideration, that the Sanhedrin being
cut off
at that time, that was
he just, his life, all he was concerned with the fact that Rome took the rule away, and that's what happened. What year it happened, he didn't care, or he didn't specify. Well, we already know in history what year it happened, which would put the sire somewhere around 12, 13. Yes, Louise.
Okay, in chapter 19, Joshua and Simeon, what happened to Shiloh during that time?
Oh, sorry. In chapter 18, first of all, Shiloh was established as a location for the next 370 years, as the location where everybody comes together on all the high days, all the holy days come together, and they all worship, as well as various other times of year.
That's where the tabernacle was.
Yes, where the tabernacle was located. It was finally established in Shiloh in chapter 18. All right. Chapter 19 is the fulfillment of other various tribes is partially with Levi and Simeon, the fulfillment of the prophecy that Jacob gave. My point in Shiloh being established right now, right at this initial point, is the beginning, because that is where law or rules starts. That's the beginning. It starts being established there, which of course corresponds to the Messiah. Shiloh being destroyed corresponds to the fact the Messiah was killed. They have a correspondence to going back and forth. That's all. I'm not going to go anything beyond that regarding any kind of other proofs or similarities. Any comments or questions before I call it quits? Sounds good.